This is Canadian Wealth Wisdom by TriDelta Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, Wealth Advisor and Portfolio Manager with TriDelta. I am joined by Paul Simon, Head of Fixed Income with TriDelta. Paul has spent the past 8 years here at TriDelta and previously worked with CI Investments in a career that spans over 25 years. Paul also obtained his CFA designation in 2004. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm happy to be back.
Before we begin, it should be noted that this podcast is intended for general information only and not as specific investment advice. You should always speak to an investment professional to determine the appropriateness of any investment or investment strategy and how it relates to your specific situation. That said, the TriDelta team welcomes a conversation to learn more. The purpose of this series is to discuss recent market developments, what we're watching, and ultimately what action TriDelta is taking within our own client portfolios. Now, two major forces dominated the prior 3 months of 2026. One was the most significant disruptions to energy supply in history, and the promise of artificial intelligence, AI. Despite the headlines and concerns over energy security, investors followed company earnings above all else, which proved resilient and boosted by enthusiasm for AI. AI was certainly the dominant force, which continued to propel markets higher, but volatility picked up in recent weeks and months. Paul, what should people make of the recent rally?
Well, I would say that AI certainly has been the dominant narrative in financial reporting and financial market scuttlebutt. The reality is that the earnings duration, the durability of the earnings strength we've seen in 2026 is a little bit broader than just an AI story. I know the equity market performance has largely been characterized by the run of the Magnificent Seven, but in reality, in recent months, we've seen a little bit of a broadening out in performance into mid-cap and smaller cap sectors. And I think that's sort of, the market's gotten used to some of these cross currents that it's been faced with, certainly since early last year. A lot of the spooky headlines in and around the conflagration in the Middle East, worries about inflation, changes at the Fed, all of these stories sort of drifted off into the background while companies were able to move forward, put up some pretty decent numbers, and continue to promise moving forward that they're going to be able to maintain profit momentum and maybe even expand margins. And investors are really enheartened by that and are willing to stick in here in the equity markets despite some rather lofty valuations of late.
You noted as one of your risks, and we talked about this in the recent market commentary that we put out, that inflation is one of the most significant challenges to investors moving forward. Can you share a little bit about what the recent contributors are to this inflation and why the risks may be different now versus coming out of the pandemic?
Sure. So inflation is not a new story and not a new challenge for investors. You know, myself as a fixed income investor is deeply concerned about inflation eating away at the income payments we receive for taking the investment risk that we do take. And we've gotten used to certain types of inflation. We're used to the virtuous wage price spiral inflation that we all learned about when we were in school, the stuff that makes the most intuitive sense, that prices rise and consumers need to get paid more to pay those higher prices. The nature of the inflation we're experiencing today is quite different, and it's starting to change through time. There have been, of course, unexpected price rises in the energy complex as a result of the ongoing war in the Middle East. We've heard rumors of some sort of supply strictures in and around the AI build-out and the tech boom. These types of increases in prices are a little harder to craft monetary policy for. If you're a central bank and you're thinking about how you can maintain the purchasing power of your currency and how you can make a stable environment for both businesses and consumers to operate in, not a whole lot you can do about the AI build-out. Not a whole lot you can do about ongoing war in the Middle East. And the reality is that the longer that these pressures are at force in our economy, the more likely it is that expectations of inflation moving forward remain high and changes the way that both companies and individuals behave. And beyond that, we've already seen it on the corporate side, whereas in recent earnings calls and communications from, you know, industry leaders like Apple, they're saying we have to pass through price increases on consumer products at a time when most people are sensitive to the potential weakness that the consumer sector might have as a result of these increasing pressures. So if you are an equity investor, you will be most certainly concerned about sticky inflation that catches the eye of central bankers who raise rates, that makes the operating environment more difficult for companies and consumers, boosts the discount rate by which you're valuing future cash flows, and could potentially be a headwind you're facing in terms of trying to make new highs in the equity market. And if you're a bond investor, you're similarly concerned because sticky inflation erodes those coupons on which we all rely for fixed income.
One of the things we wrote about was that people, or companies rather, were sort of using the Iran conflict as sort of their plausible cover for passing along some of those tariffs that they were sort of pressured against flowing through to consumers in 2025. Is that playing a big role? And how is that impacting the already ongoing affordability crisis that's played a big role, big part of consumers' mindset?
Well, the answer to that question is it depends on who you talk to. The corporate sector will tell you that for the most part, for the better part of six quarters, they absorbed a lot of the supply side shock as a result of the energy price increases and did not pass that on to consumers. We did, in fact, see some of that late last year. And then, we got communications in the first and second quarter of this year that companies were going to seek to take back some of that margin. If you talk to policymakers, particularly central bankers, they'll tell you, well, corporate profitability has never been greater. Margins weren't under any sort of meaningful pressure. And this is, you know, the corporate reaction function is much more to investor expectations of being able to grow profits full stop and or expand margins. The consumer, depending on the geography you're talking about, has performed reasonably well under these pressures. There hasn't been a whole lot of rate relief. As we know, interest rates slowly creeping higher, particularly in the long end. They haven't had a lot of the fiscal tailwinds that they received in prior years when there were tax cuts and other sorts of candy being offered to voting populaces. The consumer's been fairly resilient, but it does stand to reason that at some point here, the consumer will buckle or start to buckle, and then we'll have to look for another leg of the economy to take the yoke.
And it's a bit of a surprise that consumers have remained so strong, because one of the things that was credited coming out of the pandemic was those excess savings that people simply just weren't able to spend during the pandemic. They came out of that with all this extra cash, and that helped certainly ease some of the anxieties, but it seems like they don't necessarily have that today. Right?
For sure. And the one thing, you make a very astute point about the latent spending that happened as a result of the end of the COVID shutdowns. Even the CPI data we saw today out of the U.S., where we're seeing the inflation on the sticky side, despite the fact the headline number came in lower than expected and the core number was flat, is service inflation is actually running higher than all of the segments. And that's, again, those are exactly the types of things consumers were not able to spend on at that time and are able to and are continuing to spend on today. And we're going to see companies try to take price.
So certainly from your comments, it seems like today the interest rate story is a bit noisier. Consensus seems to think that most central banks will be raising interest rates. Where do you fall in this?
Well, the consensus thinks that because central banks have been more or less signaling that they're highly attuned to the inflationary environment, that they're not willing anymore, like they once were, to wait and see what happens with Iran, whether or not we see sort of a reversion to, you know, balanced pricing in the energy sector, if we see some more normal, you know, sort of market price mechanisms at play where companies can't just raise prices and pass them through to consumers and consumers blindly take them on. They're not willing to wait anymore. And central banks are saying, hey, we need to be on the front foot fighting inflation, which is a very different stance than they adopted, to be honest with you, in any of the last two decades in the Western world. In a Bernanke, Powell world, they were very much willing to be patient and gradual, let market forces do their thing and lie, you know, ready to be able to act in the event that things go sideways. We're seeing even today, as we record this interview, we have the new incoming Fed chairman testifying before Congress and speaking very hawkishly about wanting to fight inflation and saying that this is going to be a new paradigm shift for the Fed. So that is a more secular change with which he had to contend, very different than the way we've done business before. On the other side of things is, I think people are aware that there is a little bit of precariousness in the economy with respect to a lot of these shifting sands. We don't really have a good idea of how durable the consumer is, exactly what the appetite is for investment spending outside of AI, where's the leadership going to come from if it's not AI, or something going on in the material space if we get resumed hoarding because we're worried about further conflagrations. So in that environment, it's hard to forecast interest rates in a confident way the way we have in the past. And just that two-sided path of potential outcomes, I think, is enough to take some of the bloom out of risky assets.
And you mentioned the U.S. Fed, the new central banker or chair of that of the Fed, Kevin Warsh. He had his first meeting. He signaled that they're going to be a bit less transparent with where they see things headed. Do you think that contributes to greater market volatility?
I think it's the only thing that can happen. I know that some Fed heads within the Fed and some Fed followers without have been saying it's not that big of a deal. We've had markets that operated without guidance before, and you know that is true. Explicit guidance is something that really only came to fruition a bit in the Greenspan era and definitely with Ben Bernanke. But the reality is that was a time when there was less global interconnectivity than there is today, less coordinated policymaking across central banks, less indebtedness amongst governments and consumer sectors, and a little bit better understanding of how the geopolitical landscape is operating. And so to introduce another source of uncertainty at a time when we're still trying to figure out what the global economy looks like post-COVID, I think can only add to volatility. So, you know, we've been saying it for a while. Volatility was incoming even prior to the current U.S. administration. Even coming out of COVID, we were saying we're going to see some things. Just the nature of the way the economy operates changing was going to introduce some unknowns. Not necessarily a bad thing. It's a good thing to have two-sided outcomes to have fairly valued assets. But investors should expect maybe a little less smooth ride upwards in all risky assets as we move forward.
Canada seems like a bit of a different story. We entered a technical recession, I say that with quotation marks, earlier this year in 2026. We've got the overhang of the CUSMA uncertainty with trade with the U.S. and Mexico. It seems like a difficult sell to believe that they're going to raise interest rates from the Bank of Canada in 2026. Is that fair to say, or do you have a different take on it?
I tend to agree. And just to be clear, I'm not sure that we're going to see the magnitude of interest rate hikes out of the Bank of Canada or the Federal Reserve this year that maybe some people are expecting. Right now, the markets have them kind of evenly priced at a couple of quarter point hikes over the next 12 months or so. Canada, I think the narrative is a little bit more clear. The economy clearly is underperforming. We have a bit of a bounce back in some of the constituent data we received. Since the first quarter omnibus GDP data, we've seen an uptick in trade, an uptick in consumer activity, and it's sort of trending towards maybe second quarter coming in somewhere between 1.5% and 2% growth, which is kind of on trend for Canada. I mean, the real problem with Canada as an investable universe is that it doesn't really benefit from some of the narratives that are currently at play. We don't have the type of robust investment landscape that have obvious winners in an AI build-out. You know, we obviously have a sympathetic energy trade, but some of that story is being diluted by the ongoing tariff war with the U.S. Not that I think that any of that's going to unfold unfavorably. You know, we've proven that the trade sector is much more resilient than we thought, given the uncertainty of CUSMA. But it's a story that investors don't necessarily have to be in love with right now, and as long as that's the case, I think Canada is likely to underperform.
So moving on to what you see, how are you finding opportunities within the strategies that you manage? Is there any positioning changes? What have you been doing?
So as you well know, for quite some time, we've maintained that bond valuations for spread product, that means you know non-government bonds, any corporate bonds, provincial bonds, structured product, anything like that, credit spreads have been underwhelming. They're tight in all sectors, both investment grade and high yield. Credit spreads are as tight as we've seen in quite some time, high yield many, many years. We've never seen them this tight. And the spread between high yield and investment grade is quite tight as well. Depending on the indices you track, high yield spreads are maybe twice that of investment grade, which historically is really tight. You're not really getting paid to be involved in speculative grade credit. But that doesn't mean we can take our ball and go home. We still have to be investors here, and we've maintained a positioning that's been up in the quality tier, and primarily in the front end of the curve because we were worried about the ramifications of persistent inflation and interpretations of that dynamic into long-term interest rates. You know, the more likely that you're going to have sticky and persistent inflation, the more likely it is that your long interest rates have to move up to compensate people to lend you money for that long. And we have a canary in the coal mine in the UK that's maybe 8 years ahead of the curve of where we are in Canada and the US on that front. That position has worked out very well for us, despite the fact that we haven't been involved in some of the go-go credit names Most of the models that we own have performed better or in line with the broader universe. But now we've come to a bit of a crossroads whereby the recent pressures and interest rates to the high side, a little further out the curve, sort of 5 to 10 years out the curve, have done what they called steepen the yield curve, meaning that longer interest rates are higher relative to lower near-term interest rates. And so to be maintaining that front-end positioning, the short-end positioning, is to give up some yield and some roll-down as those bonds come shorter. And we've also seen a little bit of a steepening in the credit spreads that you get paid for non-government bonds on top of that. So in order to participate in that somewhat, and also because, as I say, I'm not entirely sure we're going to get the hikes that the market's pricing in, we're looking to extend duration here just moderately, going from the sort of the 3 to 5 year sector to the 5 to 10 year sector. And again, as we've talked about with the equity markets, the bond market's the same. Assets are overvalued, so you have to be very sticky and tight to those stories. The Canadian investment grade bond universe is highly concentrated in industrials and financials and tech. There are opportunities certainly in utilities and financials. We all know this ongoing story with Canadian banks and what they may or may not be exposed to. But the reality is the regulatory regime just got a lot easier, and we have yet to see any of those nascent fears come home to roost. So there are some opportunities in the belly of the curve, up the quality curve, to invest in financials. Utilities at the margin are toll takers, stand to position themselves pretty well in any uptick in energy demand. And they're not themselves exposed, those are their customers take on all the risk. Not a bad place to be. So we'll be adding in and around there selectively, name by name, bottom up, because this is not the type of market in which you can just throw a dart at the dartboard and hope that it pays off.
The returns in bonds generally have been rather muted in 2026. There was a time not all that long ago that people would look at bonds as a surefire way to get defense within their investment portfolios. With the rising correlation between stocks and bonds, can you still get defense from bonds today?
To be honest with you, I think you can. I think the only way that you can do it is by maintaining that high-quality defensive positioning we're engaged in. There is definitely a positive correlation between bonds and stocks right now. You see it on days where, like today, when CPI numbers come in a little bit weaker than expected, and the bond market rallies and stocks rally as well. But we're not talking about, you know, mini intraday rallies like that. We're talking about if we have something more prolonged and pronounced, like a meaningful bear market and stocks down 10% or something like that. You don't want to be in a broad-based corporate bond crossover fund where high-yield names, which are already trading expensive, will start trading back more towards their historic long-term averages. We have had episodes of that. You know, the Liberation Day tantrum was like that. Coming out of COVID, we had a couple of days like that when people remembered, oh, there's a reason why these are lower quality bonds. And then at times like that, you will see outperformance from higher grade parts of the market that will help to immunize your overall portfolio from downdrafts. But you definitely have to be selective, and you have to be tight to those stories in these rich markets.
So don't buy SpaceX bonds.
Nobody who bought SpaceX bonds is happy today.
No. So the Canadian dollar has continued to show some weakness in 2026. Is there anything going on beneath the surface here? What's the rationale for any of our cross-border shoppers?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I'm a little perplexed by the Canadian dollar story. Certainly the headline risk is there for CAD. It's been one of the weaker performers in the G7 versus the U.S. dollar over the past 3 to 6 months. It has pockets of rallies, usually in and around exorbitant oil prices and or the odd economic surprise to the upside. But more recent weeks, it's less and less benefited from those things. To be honest with you, I think it's just a case where the Canadian dollar has fallen out of the current in vogue investment suite of options. There isn't really a payoff function for a Canadian dollar this year that may have you feel more bullish than some of the other participants in the current trend. If you want to be investing in along the AI boom, Canada's not really the place you're going to want to do it. If there's going to be a more normalized trade environment as a result of the creation of some broader, more stable global trade framework, it's not clear to me that Canada benefits materially more than anybody else, because Canada already has a pretty functional trade framework with the U.S., despite the fact that CUSMA is sort of under attack and continues to be questioned. So I think it's one of those situations where CAD is not, the Canadian dollar is not itself imperiled, I don't think. We just need to have some more positive narratives in and around the Canadian economy for it to become more investable from foreign players. And beyond that, it is my suspicion that a lot of Canadian institutional participants, institutional investors who are the largest pools of capital here, are deploying vast amounts of those resources outbound into the U.S. to take part in this boom, as everybody wants to participate in what equity markets have been doing. So as a fundamental play based on valuation, I think Canadian dollar is cheap, especially if you consider that maybe the Bank of Canada doesn't ease rates and maybe just holds the line here and the Fed does the same. But for the time being, I'm being cautious and watching for what the market zeitgeist is.
Perfect. Thanks again for joining me, Paul. For any listeners who have not already read our Q2 2026 market commentary, I would encourage you to visit the insights page on our website, tridelta.ca. That concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our quarterly market update series. Thank you.